Norm Nathan's Vault of Silliness brings the final weekend of my least favorite month of the year, January, to a close with an auditory gem from January 28th and 30th, 1996. The title of this one will be A Winter Garden of Glorious Guests. We begin with the show open, and Norm asks news anchor Bob Ames about the Super Bowl. We move on to some excellent guests booked by yours truly. Oh, thank you. Please hold your applause until I've introduced the entire head table. Guest number one, Harry Carey Jr., who wrote Company of Heroes, My Life as an Actor in the John Ford Stock Company. Really entertaining interview that will leave you wanting more. Why? Because only the first segment of it is here. Guest number two. Let's now hurtle to a night when Norm was filling in for Bob Raleigh. Our guest was Bud Greenspan, Olympic historian and author of 100 Greatest Moments in Olympic History. Just an absolutely fascinating man that will have you riveted to your audio streaming devices. One observation was that the athletes who make it to this point are the best out of, now at the time, the 4,200,000,000 people on the planet. Another interesting fact, most of the 4,200,000,000 were traveling through the Sumner Tunnel and on the old Central Artery in Boston. The interview continues on side B of our well-preserved cassette. Norm and Bud really enjoy talking to each other, and Bud is looking forward to being on again. I always thought Norm had such a way with interviews. He asked more than those standard questions that were included with the press materials. The guests truly enjoyed it. You could hear it in their voices. And, off the air, when I would speak to them to thank them, they would often comment on it. Okay, let's take a call. The wonderful Billy Clyde is on the line and agrees with Norm's personal assessment. They discuss snow in Middleton, radio host Barry Farber, sneaking into events, because that was related to a guest we had on, Scott Kerman, who wrote All Sold Out, How to Sneak into Sporting Events and Concerts. He had sneaked into 5 Super Bowls and was going to update us if he got into the latest. The tape jumps to guest number 3, Francis Essex, who's written a play called Jolson. It was getting rave reviews at the Victoria Palace in London, England. We reach him at his home on the south coast of Spain, and he and Norm talk everything Al Jolson, the good and the bad, as well as the cast and all that went into putting the show together. Such an enjoyable interview, and he takes some calls. Anne in Lexington, and then Joan in Deep River, 130 miles northwest of Ottawa, Canada, but originally a Londoner. Hearing Frances talk about the theater scene in London has made her homesick. Joan shares some sweet memories. And lastly, we learn that Norm is not a fan of Ruby Keeler, nor Andrew Lloyd Webber. Episode 71, A Winter Garden of Glorious Guests, is ready to roll.
Here's Norm Nathan. He's my kind of man. I listen to Norm Nathan every time I can on WBZ in Boston, the Norm Nathan Show.
Yes, hello. Why, hello. Could I ask you a question before you leave the studio, and very quickly, Bob Ames? Do you care about the Super Bowl? Did you follow that? Were you all excited about the fact that there was one and could hardly tear yourself away from the TV set or radio?
Well, I don't get heart palpitations or anything, but I'm interested, especially if it turns out to be a good game. This was a pretty good game, which is sort of rare in Super Bowl history.
Yeah, so. It is. Most of the games are
real stinkers.
Real stinkers, I think, is the word.
That's right.
I don't know all the sports terms, but stinkers.
That one applies.
I tried to work up an interest in that, and I couldn't. And the first time I heard the score was when you announced it at 9 o'clock, which is not a real fan, I guess.
It's one of the sporting events that's really become a social occasion, too. A lot of people use it to have parties and the like. And you don't have to be a real sports fan because, especially in the history of the Super Bowl, so many of the games have been so bad. If you go to one of these Super Bowl parties, You end up watching the game for only about 5 minutes anyway.
You're busy drinking and eating.
Though tonight, I'm sure the game kept most people's attention. Even the casual fan had to like today's game.
I think a lot of people seem to be enthusiastic about Pittsburgh. Why was Pittsburgh the favorite of people?
Well, they just hate the Cowboys. You know,
why is that?
It's like the old New York Yankees. After a while, people just get tired of other people's success, you know? Sort of the way they feel about you, Norm. They're terribly envious.
I know that. You'd be surprised at the letters I get. You've been around too long, fella. Why don't you take a hike and give a kid a chance? No, but I can understand that. I guess the Dallas Cowboys have always got so much publicity, and the Dallas cheerleaders and, you know, Debbie does Dallas, and they've always been in the spotlight so much. I suppose that's true.
And they have a couple of players who are rather demonstrative about their, when they're successful, let's say. They like to express themselves, and
what do you say?
It's sort of annoys some people.
These nasty ball players.
I think the old term was hot dog, and I think there's a lot of that.
I see. Okay.
Not enough mustard in Dallas to cover some of them, I think.
So the shame is then that the Pittsburgh Steelers didn't win, and they were sort of the favorites of a lot of sports people, and it's too bad Dallas won. And the only thing I can suggest is we send the WBZ Westinghouse flying squad over Dallas, drop a few bombs on that city, devastate it, and then take off. I see nothing wrong with that.
I'm with you. You're the general. You're in charge.
Okay, this way, men. Follow me. Anyway, this is what is called the Norm Nathan Show. I don't know why it's called. I suppose because I'm sitting here, that's why it's called that. If I were not, it would be called the Robert Ames Show or whatever. And we're going to talk with a guy who's written a fascinating book, who's been in movies for a long time, his father in movies before him. His name is Harry Carey Jr. The book is called Company of Heroes, My Life as an Actor in the John Ford Star Company. It's a fascinating book. I just loved it. And we'll talk about it in just a minute.
Norm, how are you?
I'm just fine, thank you. I love the book called Company of Heroes.
Yeah.
My Life as an Actor in the John Ford Star Company. Boy, you have been in some absolutely sensational movies.
Well, I was very lucky that way, Norm. I started out in a movie with Robert Mitchum way back in 1946, and then Red River, and then Yellow Ribbon, and all those. And it was just because of those great directors, you know, Howard Hawks and John Ford. And of course, I was kind of almost related to John Ford because he was at the ranch when I was born. So, and he was very dear to me, although he gave me a rough time a few times.
And I know it.
Yeah,
your character studies of the people that you work with, I think, are just superb. Especially,
well, I'm
John
really
Ford.
Glad you enjoyed that.
I really did. Because he was, you called him Uncle Jack, and he was very close with your father, Harry Carey Sr.
Yeah. Well, they actually made each other, you know, I'm going back a long ways now because I'm 74 and my dad would be 118. But anyway, okay. They went back to the early teens and made some great Westerns together. So they more or less made each other a star, you know.
You mentioned in the book, though, you mentioned some really magical names. You mentioned, for example, when you talk about your dad going way, way back, we're talking going back to silent movies.
Right, exactly.
William S. Hart, for example. You also mentioned some great artists. You mentioned Richard, it's not Richard Russell.
Charles M. Russell.
Charles M. Russell, that's right.
Yeah.
Whose work I really have always loved, because even though I'm from the East and never have lived further west than Middleton, Massachusetts,
oh,
I guess.
Okay.
I still love the West. I've taken trips around the country.
Well, you know, my dad was from New York.
Yes, I know that, and that's always surprising.
Yeah.
And he was right from pretty much downtown New York City, wasn't he?
Well, where he was born. Of course, he was born in 1878, so...
So that was in Harlem, is now
Harlem.
Yeah,
that's right. It's where Harlem is now. But he grew up on City Island, you know, right adjacent to the Bronx there.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, but the West has always been appealing, not only Russell, but... I remember taking a trip around the country, enjoying like Remington's artwork and his sculptures and all of that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
But you were born in the West.
Yes, I was. I was born on my dad's ranch in Saugus, California, and in 1921. And so we had a great time together. It was great growing up on that place, and I got to meet some great people. And of course, it made my entrance into the picture business a little bit easier. But then, on the other hand, I felt a little more pressure, too. when I was starting out.
Yeah, the first film that you did with John Ford was Three Godfathers.
Yeah.
Back in 1948. And then, I mean, you talk about great movies. She Wore a Yellow Ribbon and Wagon Master, Rio Grande, and Mr. Roberts.
Searchers is very popular, too.
The Searchers, yeah. You were in some absolutely magnificent movies.
Well, I was just at the right place at the right time, and I happened to be in pretty good with Jack Ford, as we called him, and after that first baptism of fire on the Three Godfathers, then from then on it was pretty easy sailing, but it was really tough on that first picture.
Okay, now Jack Ford, or John Ford, as most of us would know him,
yeah,
was great on Westerns. He pretty prided himself, did he not, on being kind of the a man who put out Westerns?
Well, he made great Westerns, and he was noted mostly for that, but he won 6 Academy Awards, and none of them were for a Western.
I'd forgotten about that. Now, what did he win
the
Academy Awards?
Well, he won it for the first was The Informer.
Oh, but with Victor MacLagan.
Yeah, right, exactly. And then he won it for How Green Was My Valley, and he won it for The Quiet Man, but there's another one in there. The other two were just the movies that he made when he was in the Navy. He got special awards for those.
A lot of the movies he made had John Wayne in them.
In fact, the
Three Godfathers that you did had John Wayne.
That's right.
You paint an interesting picture of him. We think of him as, you know, a guy who has no fear at all, and yet he was intimidated, was he not, by John Ford?
Yeah, he was. In fact, I think more so, and this isn't a put down, it's just the truth, more so than the rest of us were.
He seemed
to have a tremendous... Ford had a tremendous power over Duke. And he's such a huge man physically. And Ford was not a tiny man, but certainly no match physically for Duke Wayne. But it was just that Ford had this tremendous power over him. And he, of course, respected Ford so much. And he learned a great deal from him.
Yep.
One thing I'd like to say about the book, Norm, is that many of the bookstores don't have it. There's some of them have it, some of them don't. So I'd like to give you a number for the listeners to jot down.
Okay, hang on while I pull out my pen.
All
because
right.
People are going to ask me about this later, and I want to have the number.
Oh, okay, great.
This is an 800 number, I assume, is it?
Yes, it is. It's Scarecrow Press.
Yeah.
And it's 1-800-462-6420.
Okay, if you study the theater... or movies at all, and you care about the history of movies, it would be hard to find a reason for not including Company of Heroes among your collection, because you got so many interesting stories. 1-800-462-6420, Scarecrow Press.
Right.
Okay, that sounds...
What happened was that there's been about 5 books, or 6 maybe, written about the career of John Ford and the life of John Ford. But no one had written a book, and I've written as a hobby for a long time, but no one had written a book about that had actually been on the set or worked for him, you know. So I think mine is really up close and personal, and it was just the most incredible experience working on those 9 movies with him.
Okay.
So I had to get that down on paper.
Okay, Duke Wayne, or...
Yeah,
we civilians call him John Wayne.
Yeah,
you mentioned he was intimidated by John Ford, but it seemed like everybody was, and you sort of watched John to see whether he was happy that day, whether he was not. You mentioned dark glasses, so you never knew who he was looking at.
You never knew where he was looking, though.
No. Yeah. So.
Well, you know, there's something, Norman, that's interesting is that he was he wasn't the only so-called tyrannical director or at times, sadistic director. There were many of those in Hollywood back in those days. I don't think there's very many anymore, thank goodness. But there were quite a few then. Henry Hathaway and Otto Preminger and Michael Curtiz, guys like, they were tough guys to work for.
Now, you say there aren't many like that now.
Well, I don't work as much as I used to.
Okay.
But I don't know of any that are that quite dictatorial.
I've just wondered if that wasn't the era of... directors who were directors or something, and maybe the whole attitude toward movies or something has changed. I wondered why that's not doesn't appear to be so true anymore.
Well, I think one of the reasons is that a lot of those guys were graduates from the silent days, and they sort of modeled themselves after the old-timer, D.W. Griffith.
You know what? One feeling I always had was that sometimes technology moves faster than it ought to.
Yes, it does.
And because you were talking about, we were talking about silent movies and W.S. Hart and all that,
yeah,
and all that kind of stuff. And I always felt that silent, and I say this only because I would love your opinion on this, but it seems to me that the silent movies were reaching a point of great artistry, and suddenly sound came in, and that, of course, wiped out silent movies. There was going to be no further development.
Yeah.
And if people could hear the movies, they were not going to go back to silent movies anymore. And maybe we kind of wiped out some of the artistic developments that were taking place in silent movies before that.
You are absolutely right. They made some incredible silent movies. I enjoy watching them now. I have some tapes of silent movies, and the camera told the whole story, you know. And I think we've lost that technique, and they put in too much talking now.
Because the early talkies, they'd bury a microphone in a flower pot or in a phone, and you'd see people leaning over talking.
My dad told me all about that. And another thing that happened, which was very sad, not so much with the ladies, but with the men actors, was that everything was voice, you know.
Yes.
So that if a guy even had a normal voice, if it didn't sound like a sensorial voice or some kind of incredibly deep, resonant voice, they wouldn't, you know, his contract was over.
No, this Sid Caesar on your show of shows way back in the early days.
Oh,
of television.
I love those.
Yeah, he used to do takeoffs on that, you know, where a silent movie actor suddenly got in sound, and he'd be talking up here somewhere, you know, and his whole career was ended.
Well, I read, you know, the big tragic story was of John Gilbert.
Yes.
And when sound came in, that they said they laughed. Well, then there was a story that Louis Mayer hated him, and he changed the sound to make his voice sound funny. So I don't know if that's a true story or not, but it ruined his career, and he had a rather normal voice.
Yeah, that's interesting. Incidentally, one side issue about Louis Mayer, which people in this area I think would appreciate. Louis Mayer, although he was born in Europe, came to this country and lived in a city called Haverhill, Massachusetts.
Exactly.
You know about that then? Because my mother
is from Massachusetts.
Yes, and my mother was born in Haverhill, and a lot of my relatives were from there anyway. And I live not far from there even now, but within 14, 15 miles. But a lot of people are not aware the mayor of Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer started out there and started a movie theater there. And I guess in order to get, as you movie folks call it, product, that is film,
yeah,
he went to Hollywood and started making movies so he'd have something to show at his theater. But I think the first theater that Louis Mayer had was in Haverhill, right in eastern Massachusetts.
Well, for goodness sakes.
I just thought I'd just tell you something because
I'm
a smart ass.
I knew he came from there. I thought, and he also, before that he had the theater, didn't he have a junkyard or a...
Oh, I'm sure of that.
He was in a junk business or something.
I'm sure of that because as an immigrant, I'm sure he tried to make a buck any way he could.
Well, you know what? Those guys knew the business, though. You know, Sam Goldwyn and all those fellows, Harry Cohn, they all started out on the very low rung of the ladder, you know. But they knew what the public wanted, and they had the great big companies and the great big studios to make, you know, those kind of movies.
Isn't that interesting, though, what you just said? The fact is they had this instinct, and you wonder, how did they get this instinct? Did they listen to people more than other people have done?
I don't know, but, you know, Adolf Zucker and... Skanks and all of those guys, they were just geniuses at turning out one hit after another.
You were talking about, your father, Harry Carey Sr.
Yeah.
And
there's one
section in your book, almost made me cry. I thought it was just so beautiful. You don't mind if I tear up while I tell you about it?
No, of course not.
Let's see if I can find it in the book so I can read it the way you wrote it. The movie... Three Godfathers, which was your first dealing with John Ford.
Right.
You mentioned your father was gone by then, and they wanted to Ford wanted to dedicate the movie to your father.
Right.
And so here's a, it said, let's see, What you tell us about that, how they dedicated the movie and how they got a guy to wear your father's clothing on a horse, your old horse, or his old horse, Sonny.
Sonny, yes.
Yeah, tell us about that incident, because
well,
I think that's so
beautiful.
Well, it was a beautiful
thing. I'd left the set for it. We were working out at the RKO Pathé in Culver City, and I was left the set to go to the bathroom. When I was coming back from the bathroom, between the sound stages, I saw a horse trailer there, and I saw Sonny tied to the horse trailer, and it said Fat Jones Stables on there, and I knew that Fat Jones's boys had gone out and picked up Sonny from the farm and brought him over to the studio, and they had him all cleaned up, and he looked terrific, and he whinnied when he saw me, and just as I was petting him, the door to the sound stage opened, and John Ford came out, and he said, why don't you go home, kid? He said, I don't want you to see this. And I said, yes, sir, okay. So I said goodbye to Sonny, and I went back to the dressing room and changed and drove home. And what he was shooting was Cliff Lyons, who was the head stunt coordinator and also a friend of my dad's, put on my dad's clothes, or clothes exactly like my father wore. Cliff was a little bit bigger. And he got on Sonny, and they had an exterior, where this hill, and he actually acted out exactly the way my dad would, rode up onto the hill and pushed his hat back and leaned back on the horse and the sunset in the background, and said, to Harry Carey, the bright star of the early western sky, this motion picture is affectionately dedicated.
Oh, I know that. I read that. I read the way he wrote that, and it almost made me cry. I thought that was just so beautiful.
It makes me cry, too.
Do you see that now? You must have a copy of that, a video. Do you have a video of that?
Oh, of course.
And do you still choke up when you see that?
I sure do. I get choked up when I see Duke in that picture. He was so powerful in that picture, and Pedro Almendarez. It's a very, very touching, beautiful movie, Three Godfathers.
Yeah, they can. That's right, Three Godfathers.
Yeah.
There can be nobody who's imitated more than John Wayne is, you know.
No, I know it.
When I talk about him, I want to do an imitation. You know, let's hitch up the horses and get out of here. Everybody
well,
does
he really
that.
Talked that way. You know, he just didn't do that on the screen. And he was a good guy to work with. He really was.
I want to talk about him and about some of the other people you work with. We'll just take a little break.
Okay.
Harry,
careful.
Nathan, he's the talk of the town. Lift you up when you're down. Norm Nathan on WBZ in Boston.
Okay, this actually is the Bob Raleigh Show. Bob is taking the night off. He's making a worldwide tour of some of the major capitals of Europe. No, he's going to a play and all that kind of stuff. So he'll be back with you tomorrow. And I thought maybe, you know, I had nothing else to do. I'm sitting at home, you know, I'm feeding the dogs and the cat and the horse and the chicken. I got nothing to do. So I thought, hey, go on and do a program. Help the kid out. And we are. Interesting guest, a man named Bud Greenspan, who is probably one of the greatest authorities on the Olympics. And, of course, the Summer Olympics are in Atlanta this year. Anyway, we'll talk with Bud. Fascinating book he's got out, and his whole career is fascinating. Films coming up on the Olympics. That'll be on television in April. Anyway, we'll talk about that in just a minute. But first, stories about those magic moments in Olympic history. A book I know that you will enjoy. Anyway, Bud, it's good of you to come on the program with us. I really appreciate it.
Nice talking to you, Norm.
Okay. I just wondered how you could sum up things in just with 100, you know, great moments, because there must have been a ton more moments than that were just great.
As in everything, Norm, as you know, it's easy to put into a book, but the most difficult part are the great ones that you have to leave out. We've had that same problem in our making in our films, where do you start and where do you stop? I think the book might rightfully called My Memorable Moments, because sometimes they don't have anything to do with people standing on a victory podium. They have to do with personal relationships with me, which were great. And there were many personal situations involved with me and the Olympians since I've been to every game since 1948. So it's sort of my life in the Olympics.
And your life has been so closely tied in with the Olympics, probably more so than most anybody else, I would think. Some of the people that you write about, I guess, are relatively obvious, like Jesse Owens, who in 1936 defied Adolf Hitler when the games were in Berlin.
Right.
And they figured the Aryans, the German bloods, were the only ones who could win because, you know, athletically they were superior to anybody. And here comes this black American just playing games with them, who did so well. That's an obvious one.
Well, Jesse was my best friend, so he not only was in because he was the greatest, but you're quite right in what you said. He upset the whole Aryan racial supremacy theory of a master race practically all by himself.
And there was a... tell us about the kind of a reunion in Berlin later on where Jesse Owens returned, and obviously Hitler was not in power at that point. Anyway, you have a section on that.
Well, it's very interesting because he went back in 1951, and it was between halftime of a Harlem Globetrotter basketball game, and now he's 36 years old, and the loudspeaker at halftime said, "Ladies and gentlemen, the champion of champions returns. I give you Jesse Owens," and he steps onto the red cinder track that was untouched by Allied bombing during the war. And he makes a victory lap he was unable to take 15 years earlier when he competed before Hitler and Goebbels and Goering and Himmler and what have you. And suddenly a chant started as he made this 400-meter run around the track, the victory lap, "Jesse Owens, Jesse Owens." Mm. Jesse knew that many of the people there that day were there in 1936 because that was the same chant. And he finished his run, and he ran to the spot where Hitler had stood. And this time he was greeted by the mayor of West Berlin, who held up his hand. And the crowd quieted, and into the microphone he said, "Jesse Owens, 15 years ago, Hitler refused to shake your hand. I'll try to make up for today by taking both of them."
Oh, yeah.
And he grabbed Owens by the hands and embraced him. It was just a beautiful story.
Yeah, there are so many stories you have in your book that just want to make you want to cry. The human, I don't know quite how to phrase this, but you're almost so proud of the human race. There's so many obstacles that so many people who have taken part in the Olympics have overcome, someone they were terribly wounded that you talk about.
Well, there's probably my favorite story is that of John Stephen Aquari of Tanzania, who was the last man in the marathon at the 1968 Mexico City Olympics, finishing an hour after the winner and practically carrying his bloody bandaged leg with him into the stadium, hobbling around the track, taking about 10 minutes together with very few people in a cold, dark Mexico City evening. All the spectators had practically gone. And he finally crosses the finish line, exhausted and bloodied, as I said, bandaged and very hurt and in much pain. And I went over to him later on and I said, "John, why did you do this? You had no chance of winning. You had every opportunity to leave the race. No one would have minded if you had because of your injuries." And he looked at me like I was crazy, Norm, and finally he said, "Mr. Greenspan, I don't think you understand. My country did not send me 9,000 miles to start the race. They sent me 9,000 miles to finish the race."
I reread that sentence about 10 times. I thought that was so beautiful.
Well, that's what it's all about, isn't it? You know, there's more philosophy in some of these athletes who don't know how smart they are or how much they can give to the spectators of the world. If anything, what I wanted the book to do, or I hope the book will do, will make more participants out of spectators who I think in our society today, Norm, too many people are getting vicarious thrills out of other people's talents. And thank God for the spectators of the world, but we have gotten nice response from people who suddenly say, "I'm going to write the novel," or "I'm going to go out and exercise." And that's exactly what I want this book to do.
I know. You know, I've always wished that we could have more than one lifetime so that we could really do a whole lot of things. I looked through your book, and you talk about everybody from, like, Sonia Henie. I think people who remember from the movies forget that she was an Olympic skater,
yeah,
too, and, you know, and all that kind of stuff. But you kind of want to, you're so inspired by your book, for example, I want to become an athlete. It's too late now.
Well, it is pretty interesting you said that, because they inspire me, and that's nice of them. Many times we get letters from the athletes whom we depict in film or in written form, and they say, you know, we inspire them. So it's a nice relationship. You know, one of the interesting things about athletics is that what they have is quite transposable to the real world. Basically, we're talking about talent and pride and courage and the ability to endure. And all of us have those qualities. We just don't use them as well as a dedicated athlete does, who does 7 days a week. As Jesse Owens once told me when I asked him, what was it like at the start of the 100-meter dash in Berlin in 1936, just before the starting gun went off? And he said, Bud, it was a lifetime of training for just 10 seconds. And when you start to think about that, Norm, you realize how ungracious many of us are when we see these people come for their 10 seconds or 2 minutes and 4 minutes and finish in fourth place or sixth place. We don't pay any attention to them. There's something wrong with our lack of courtesy, because these are the best in the world. And next summer in Atlanta, you're going to have 10,000 young men and women who all got there for the same reason. They're the best. And how often can you be involved with something that has 10,000 of the best?
No, obviously that's quite true. You mentioned, among other people, for example, Oksana. I'm not even sure I'm pronouncing the name right.
Oksana Bayul.
Bayul, from who's from the Ukraine.
Yes.
Who is a young kid. I mean, she's a child.
Well, you know, everybody talked about Nancy Kerrigan and Tanya Harding, and that became the 2 weeks of conversation, and many weeks before the Lillehammer Winter Olympic Games. But Oksana Bayul was the real story. A young kid, orphaned early in life, the day before the final, she has her leg cut and doesn't have to have Novocaine put in on her first leap. She's not certain whether she's going to be able to feel her foot when she lands. Puts on a perfect performance. And if you had seen this in a movie, you'd say, hey, bud, cut it out. Well, yeah, these things don't happen. You don't have an orphaned kid who's hurt the night before the final. That happens in fiction, but this happened in life. And I think those are the inspirational stories that young people should be getting to these days, as opposed to the anti-heroes that many people in our business are creating.
I know you, because again, I don't want to belabor Oksana Bayul, but her father died when she was very young. She never knew him. I guess he left home when she was a small child.
That's right. That's right.
Her mother died of cancer when she was 13. That is when Oksana was 13. And then her grandparents, who raised her, with whom she lived, they died, and her coach emigrated to Canada.
Right.
From, you know, I mean, here was a kid, 14 years old was she at the time, who had everything going against her.
Exactly. And she comes up. One of the things that's marvelous about the Olympic Games, and it's an expression I've used before, is on a given day, at a given time, at a given hour, something magical can happen. Some of the athletes have hit their peak at that particular time, never reaching the peak before in their lifetime, never afterward, that given moment. And that's the magic of it, the tradition of it. It's 3,000 years old, the history of the Olympic Games. The fact that it's held every 4 years makes it unique. So I think we're talking about, you know, I've been involved, and I'm sure you've been involved, Norm, with the best in the city, the best in the state, the best in the country. But when you're dealing with the best in the world, the best of 4,200,000,000 people, there's something very special attached to that.
I know we talk about, you know, about the Olympics, but if you don't win the gold, you kind of failed in some way. Because you talk about people who just won silver, and I think just to qualify to be a part of the Olympics is incredible. The percent, the chances of anybody getting that far in their athletic career. It's got to be so rare.
Well, 10,000 people, young men and women, are going to be in Atlanta next summer. All of them gotten there for the same reason. They're the best to come forth from their native country. And only 600 are going to come back standing on the top step of the victory podium. And so we're talking about 9,400 who are not going to win the gold medal. Yeah, they should be honored because they've given up so many years of their lives so that we can have what I have called in my film the 16 Days of Glory. I think it's 2 weeks of Never Never Land. As I said, I've been to every game since 1948. There's a spirit, there's a camaraderie, there's a relationship that if we could just continue the 300-some-odd days after the games would be a better world.
There's always this dispute, Bud Greenspan, about Do we subsidize our athletes enough to enter the Olympics? And do other countries do that to the point where our amateurs are competing against people you could call professionals. I'd be interested in your thoughts about that.
It's becoming less and less that way. Up until the Soviet Union was broken up and the Berlin Wall knocked down, there was a major problem with the East European countries and the Soviet Union having professional athletes in the United States. Having to have their kids go out to work after 21, so they're missing one of their greater opportunities. Quite frankly, what a lot of people don't know, Norm, is that the Olympic Games is going to be almost totally professional by the year 2004. President Samaranch of the International Olympic Committee has made it well known that the Olympic Games have to have the best athletes, and the best athletes more than any other time are professionals. So I don't think that's going to be a problem anymore. The problem I think that's going to take place is that perhaps before 4 or 8 years go by, the athletes are going to be asking for a piece of the financial pie, and that perhaps there's going to be generally around the board in every sport cash prizes, I think, before another 8 years go by.
Okay, because we have the fabled Boston Marathon here, which now is giving away cash prizes and stuff in order to get athletes who would compete, or runners who would compete in other marathons in other parts of the country. But in order for them to get everybody, you know, all the big names, they had to do that.
Exactly.
Are we losing something by this? Does that change things at all?
Yes, it does. And I think, but again, I have to quote Samaranch as saying that the Olympic Games and sport is moving parallel with the times, and everything has become commercial. I think one of the things that I responded to, and people have asked the same question, and I still say I'd rather spend 100% of my on the 90% that still remains that is good than a lot of my colleagues who spend 100% on the 10% that's not so good. If we're looking for perfection in our world today, we're not going to get it in business or sport. And unless I want to remove myself from this planet, I have to go along with society and sport too. I think in what I do, being an independent producer, I can still make the shows that I used to think were marvelous when I was growing up, when I had heroes to look after, that people do compete for the honor and glory of sport still, because many of our stories have to do with kayaking and judo, and these people don't make commercial endorsements after they win gold medals.
Yeah, you don't get too many people endorsing kayaks, I suppose. No, that's true. I guess this is sort of a philosophical kind of thing. What do you need to be a real Olympic champion? I know that's a kind of a general, vague kind of
thing.
You're
almost giving me a preview of an article that I have the cover story in Parade magazine on Sunday, February 19th, and it's called What Makes an Olympic Champion? And I went around to about 15 of the great ones from the past and present, and I've got every answer from dedication, inspiration, love of country, and love of family. I want to do it for this, I want to do it. And all have basically the same idealistic response. The one that interested me most was from Peter Snell, the great New Zealand runner of 1960 and 1964, who's considered by many the greatest middle-distance runner in history. And I asked Peter, he says, don't let anybody ever tell you that's all these things. It is dedication. It is all the things that you were talking about. But, Bud, he said, it's basically ego. You like the idea of being the best. And, you know, I'm going to be the first to confess, I like being the best in the world.
Because it seems to me that you can get two athletes that are blessed with the same kind of talents, and one has got to have something a little bit beyond that to win, even though maybe physically they're both about the same.
Maybe, well, maybe
that's it, what you said, the ego factor.
One of the expressions I used in my last film when we were talking about Evelyn Ashford, who lasted five different Olympic Games and was one of the great Olympic champions of all time. And I wrote, the difference between Evelyn Ashford and those who come after her is Evan Lashford lasts a few seconds longer. And something like that.
The whole thing is really a few seconds, isn't it? You win an event, a running contest, whatever, by seconds, maybe a fraction of a second.
You know, in the 1980 luge competition, the Winter Games, you know, when they slide on their bellies like we used to when we were kids, the difference between first and eighth place after two runs down the hill was 21,000ths of a second.
Isn't
between
it?
First and eighth place.
Oh, no. Isn't that something?
I mean, you can blink faster than that.
So when you lose something in the Olympics, you know, I suppose it's still a loss, and I suppose obviously it makes you feel badly because you want to win, but it doesn't really amount to anything, hardly.
No, it doesn't. But we always talk about losing by an infinitesimal part of an inch and a fraction of a second, and it bears out. You know, we're talking about the 100 meters that's going to take place in Atlanta between first and eighth place. Is imperceptible sometimes, except by the clock. And, you know, 50 years ago, there would be many races that would be ending in dead heat because they only went to a tenth of a second. And so often now in downhill racing in the Winter Games and alpine skiing, the only way you can tell the winner is because of timing. And when they cut it down, when they have it to a hundredth of a second, that has made winners where 50 years ago, when it was a tenth of a second, it would be a tie.
The human body that appears to me to be capable of doing more than it could do 50 years ago. Are we faster now? Are we stronger?
Oh, yeah. The food, the conditioning. There's an old wives' tale that Jim Thorpe, called the greatest athlete of all time, couldn't make his high school team if he was playing today, which is basically true. Because, there are women who won the 100-meter freestyle in Barcelona three summers ago would have defeated the 1960 male winner.
That's interesting.
The progress that has taken place. You know, the first pole vaulter that won the pole vault in 1896 in Athens would leap 10 feet 2 inches. Bupka is going to win next summer jumping over 20 feet, twice as much. So it's really... there was no such animal as getting extra money in 1900, 1904, 1908 for breaking world records. Ever since commercialism came into sport, when record breakers became important because they made more money, the first time a world record, I think, became important is when Johnny Weissmuller was the first man to swim the 100-meter distance under 1 minute. Then it became famous when Roger Bannister ran the mile under 4 minutes.
Yeah.
It wasn't in the early days that they had these barriers that were lucrative if you overcame them.
And that's interesting because I remember, you know, the question was, can anybody run the mile in less than 4 minutes? Then it became common.
Yeah, well, you know, in those days, Bannister was actually petrified since he was a medical student. That he might die if he ever tried to attempt it, because British scientists and doctors said it's physically impossible for the body to take it. And I remember interviewing him. They said as he was going into the last lap, and the announcer said 3 minutes, and he had 400 meters to go and had to do it under a minute. He said he had to make a decision as to whether he wanted to attempt it or maybe perhaps die. He says, what the hell? Anyway, crosses the finish line, collapses for about 10 seconds, awakens up and says, when he thought he was dead, he says, it looks pretty much like Earth. It must be still alive.
Let me just take a break.
Damn Olympics for women. And it was a very close race. And at the finish line, as men did in the previous 800-meter race for men, a couple of the women fell down. Well, this caused a great furor that these poor women fell down at the finish, being exhausted, as they should have been. So they were barred from running in the Olympic Games anything longer than 100 meters for 32 years. They couldn't run till 1960.
Mm.
And then, of course, in 1984 in Los Angeles, the circle was completed when women ran their first marathon. But interestingly enough, there's going to be a new sport coming up in a couple of years, just begun by women, because they thought that the upper body strength was not there, that they couldn't do the pole vault. The women are now doing pole vault. and doing the triple jump, all because of these old wives' tales that women could not compete in the same athletic event as the men. By the year 2008 or maybe 2012, there'll be a decathlon instead of a heptathlon. You know, the seven events that decided who is the finest all-around woman athlete in the world. Mm-hmm. They're now doing seven events over 2 days, as the men are doing 10. But I think in about 8 to 12 years, it'll be a 10-event decathlon for women also.
Do you see any point where men and women will compete in the same event?
I doubt it very much. So the only thing I can think of is golf. I don't think they'll compete in the same events. Okay. It's still the matter of strength and endurance and body formation, which is a definite physical factor of life.
Okay, leave us with our illusions about being stronger. I remember I once went skiing, for the first time I had gone skiing with my wife, and we were on the little baby slopes because neither one of us skied before. And then we get down to the bottom, and there was a question of who's going to ski back to the lodge, and who is going to take the bus back. And they said to my wife, you can ski back. You're doing very well. And to me, they said, you better take the bus back. I mean, any illusions I had about guys automatically being better than women at sports was out the window. But I can understand that when it comes to really, really great strength, I guess men are built differently.
Well, you know, women are in weightlifting now, and they're in all the sports, the physical and acrobatic sports like gymnastics and diving and everything else. They always thought that the strength sports, because of the upper body strength of men being so far superior to women, that they couldn't lift themselves over the bar in the pole vault. But it's getting to that point because pole vaulting is going to be in the Olympics very soon.
What month is the Summer Olympics?
They begin July 19th and go through August 6th. It's midsummer in Atlanta.
Yeah.
And our films, as you probably know, have been called 16 Days of Glory for the last four times we've done them. We have to change the title because they're putting an extra day and it's starting on Friday night, so it's 17 Days of Glory.
Okay. And I have a note here that says that two of your latest films will be premiering on TBS, that's the Turner,
yes.
Turner Broadcasting, 100 Years of Olympic Glory on April 15th,
yes,
and America's Greatest Olympians on June 30th.
That's right.
Okay, I'll remind people as we get closer to
Super.
Those dates. That's great. Let's take some phone calls and see what people would like to ask you, Bud Greenspan.
Okay.
A little more emotional. Where somebody who is not really expected to win, the odds against that athlete, but did come on to win, some story like that. Are there certain ones that stand out in your mind?
Well, I did a feature film, Norm, called Wilma. It was the life of Wilma Rudolph, and this is like bad fiction, only it happened. She could not walk without braces because of childhood illnesses and partially polio till the time she was 12, and the family was afraid that she would not be able to walk properly. 8 years after she wears her first good pair of shoes, she becomes a triple gold medal winner at the Olympic Games of Rome in 1960. Mm. I mean, that's one of the great stories. And then there's a story that we did for the Winter Games, of course, Dan Jansen, who had to skate in 1988 in the Calgary Games on the day that his sister dies, and he falls down twice and misses his chance at Olympic immortality. Then in 1992, he tries again and then misses twice again when he's a favorite, then coming back in 1994 in the last race of his career. On the same day that his sister died, only 6 years later, he wins the gold medal, and as he's standing on the victory platform, he's remembering those days when his sister was dying and he had to skate. And he wanted to pay some attention to her, some tribute to her. So as the Star Spangled Banner is coming to a conclusion, he looks up to the sky and raises his hand to his forehead in a salute, and as if he was saying, "Thank you, Jane, for being there, because you were responsible for me finally winning the gold medal."
Well, you have a lot of beautiful stories like that in the book.
Yeah.
One is about the L.I.S. Did she pronounce it Liz Hartel? The writer.
Oh yeah. Well, she had polio, and she was in the dressage, which is the perfect example of coordination between animal and human, and it's setting the horse through a series of routines that are all affected by the thigh and the leg. And when she had polio, everybody thought for all intents and purposes, her life in sport was over. But she prevailed. She competed, I believe, in the 1952 Olympic Games and won the silver medal on two occasions. And one of the more dramatic moments in the when they were giving her a medal, she couldn't get up to the victory podium. So the man who won in first place, a guy by the name of Saint-Cyr from France, got down off the top step, and he stood on the silver medal step with her because he wanted to have her company, and held her up as the Star Spangled, as the national anthem was being played. These things, Norm, again, if we didn't document them, they'd be almost fictional. But the story I think that is the most courageous, if you don't mind me telling it to you, is a Hungarian pistol shooting champion by the name of Károly Takács. He blew off in his right hand. He wakes up 3 days later, his right hand, right arm, amputated. What does an athlete do for all intents and purposes? His lifetime quest is now over. His friends and family lost contact with him for a time. They thought he was contemplating suicide. They found out what happened to him 3 years later at London's Wembley Stadium, for there he was standing atop the victory platform, the winner of the pistol shooting championship. He won using his left hand, a hand he had never used before.
Oh, jeez.
And, you know, when you hear these things, you're saying, is this guy crazy? Where do you make these stories up? It sounds like something Bill Stern, that famous sports announcer many years ago, who never told the truth.
That's right.
So we had to go over to Hungary to document this, because they're so, it really brings out the cliche that truth is stranger than fiction.
Yeah, it's funny you mentioned Bill Stern. The Colgate...
Comedy Alley.
Well, it should have been called the Comedy Alley. It was called the Sports Newsreel or something like that. Yeah, but at the beginning, Bill Stern would say, talk about these dramatic stories, some fiction, some made up. I mean, he didn't say it that way, but he said it very quickly.
You remember the last thing he said? And that man's name was...
That's right, too. And he was lying there, and he was looking for the crack in the ceiling, the sun shining down on him, trying to lift himself up from the canvas. Yeah. And finally he did, and he... And that man was Bud Greenspan.
Winston Churchill.
Yeah, no, I remember those stories so well. But he did issue a disclaimer at the beginning. I never noticed that back when I used to listen to him as a kid.
Yeah, I too.
But I've listened to some of his stuff recently, and the disclaimer's there, and I guess we didn't want to believe it. But you have no disclaimers in your book at all.
No.
I mean, these are real people going through
really
real heartaches.
Yeah.
Because you mentioned, you know, people. For a guy who lost his pistol shooting hand and then take it up on the other side,
it seems like it's impossible. I just
don't see that. This whole book is like that in a sense. It's a tribute to the American spirit. That woman we were talking about, the equestrian.
Yeah.
Now she had to be lifted up to her horse and taken down. She had recovered to a certain point in the podium,
but
not totally.
Yeah, but here's a story about Jeff Farrell, the 1960 finest 100-meter swimmer in the world, destined to win 3 gold medals in the 100-meter freestyle and the relays. And 5 days before the American Olympic trials, he wakes up at 3 o'clock in the morning in excruciating pain. To save his life, a burst appendix, had an emergency operation. And the Olympic trials are 5 days away. And now the Olympic Committee says, we'll give you some dispensation. You don't have to swim. He says, no, I want to be the same as everybody else. So the stitch is still in him.
Oh, jeez.
He swims, makes the team. 2 months later, he anchors both relay teams to world records and to gold medals. And did this all getting on the team with the stitches still in him after his operation.
No after effects at all?
None at all.
No? He wasn't... I thought maybe there might be an unhappy part to that story.
The beauty of this thing is the Olympic Committee was going to give him an opportunity to recuperate for an extra 2 weeks, and he wouldn't take this opportunity. He said, look, I want to be like everybody else. This is the way the ball bounces. This is the way the dice are rolled. I don't want any special help.
Are there any special countries, small countries, for example, that win way beyond what you would think that they would have won? I mean, I can understand the United States winning a lot of events. We get a lot of people here, a lot of sports, all that kind of stuff. I'm asking an impossible question, I think.
Well, actually, for a small country, when it was still a country, East Germany did fabulously in the Summer Games since the end of World War II. For the amount of people that they had in the country and the amount of winners that they had, it was quite incredible. But, of course, we don't want to go into the politics of the machinery that made them what they were and will no longer be. And that is taking these kids when they were 2 or 3 years old and say, you're going to be a weightlifter, you're going to be a gymnast, you're going to be this, taking them out of their homes and from their families and just creating monsters, athletic monsters. Thank God for the fall of the wall and the breakup of the Soviet Union, because it was getting a little bit like futuristic, creating test tube athletes. It's going to be Carl Lewis. You know, he's probably the most phenomenal athlete of the 20th century, starting off in 1984, and he'll be 35 years old 12 years later in Atlanta. He's won 8 gold medals, has an opportunity to win a couple of more at Atlanta. And if he does, win 2, because he has a chance in the long jump and will certainly anchor the relay team. He'll become the greatest gold medal winner in American and United States history. And being able to compete on the world-class level for 12 years as a sprinter, it's quite phenomenal. And I think we'll also be looking for Dan O'Brien to win the decathlon that he did not win in Barcelona because of he missing out in the Olympic trials. But he's the finest all-around athlete in the world and should give the American gold. And Janet Evans is going to try and make a comeback, our great female swimmer who has won 3 gold medals in 2 previous Olympics. I think you'll see a lot of veterans coming back, but in connection with who I'm looking forward to, I can tell you better in about 2 or 3 months when the Olympic trials take place.
Okay, are there many events that are part of the Olympics now that were not a few years ago that they would have scoffed at?
Yeah, baseball. You know, baseball became a sport in 1984. There's now mountain bike riding coming in this year. There's beach volleyball coming in this year. Entertaining sports are moving into the Olympic arena. You know, up until 1984, tennis was not in the games. And so you're coming around to a lot more popular sports coming into the games than before. They used to be more lyrical and more traditional. But now that you got baseball and beach volleyball, softball has come into the Olympic Games. Each host city has an opportunity to introduce a new exhibition sport in each every 4 years. And if it works, they keep it in. If it doesn't work, they dump it.
Okay. You know, it's been a great pleasure to talk with you, Bud. I really appreciate
it. Oh, it's my pleasure. Have me again, would you?
I would love to do that. And thank you for asking. Oh. And I wanted to mention the name of the book again, a special centennial edition, 100 Greatest Moments in Olympic History by Bud Greenspan. It really is an inspiring book, and your films are inspiring, and we'll look for them this July.
Thanks a million.
Thank you, and we'll be in touch again, Bud, because you're an interesting man.
See you soon. Bye.
Bye-bye now. Okay, I'm doing okay, but, you know, as I've told you before, my standards are low.
Yes, I found that to be true. Norm, I saw your hometown. It's quite a quaint little town. I saw it on network news one morning during the Blizzard 96, and I said, my God, they're showing me Middleton now.
Was it really? Middleton was on television?
Yeah, absolutely.
I never did get to see that.
It was on CBS All Night News, whatever they call that news. I was sitting there watching it, the news junkie that I am, and I said, my Lord, that's Norm's. And they were like up to here in snow, and it showed a snow plow traversing, wending its way down the street there, and snow was really socked in all around, and I was impressed with the neat, tidy homes, pretty good-sized homes with nice lots, and I said, gee, that's Uncle Normie's place.
Oh, son of a gun, I wish I'd seen that.
I don't know why they singled out Middleton, but but they did, nevertheless.
Maybe the photographer, maybe, or the cameraman, maybe was stuck there on his way to someplace else. I don't know.
Yeah, and Barry Farber, I know him. He's from Greensboro, my home.
He's the talk host?
Yeah, the one that's been on the radio all these years. He's a real smart guy. I know him personally.
Oh,
we
really?
Grew up together and went to the same high school.
Oh, he's from the South. I didn't realize
he's from
that.
From Greensboro, my home.
Son of a gun,
he's a local boy made good.
Yeah, he's been in New York for years
and
years.
He went to the University of North Carolina and starred on the gymnasium team down there on the horizontal bar. He was quite an athlete, and he was head of the Torchlight Society, which was a debating club, and I think he was president of his class. I don't recall because he was a couple of years ahead of me. But he's a smart guy, and I enjoy listening to him on the radio.
Son of a gun, he's still on the air, too.
Oh, yeah, we have him here locally every day. We have his show in the afternoon. I think it runs 2 hours. But I was just wondering if the guy that you were talking to a couple of nights ago ever called you back as to whether or not he got in, was successful in sneaking in the Super Bowl.
Oh, yeah, no, I haven't heard from him. He's promised to call back. And he said he had it pretty well made because he had made arrangements ahead of time. I'm just looking for the story on that. But, yeah, he was kind of, he's the one who wrote the whole book on how to sneak into concerts and all that kind of stuff. Scott Kerman.
Right.
And the book is called All Sold Out, How to Sneak into Sporting Events and Concerts. And he was down in Tempe, Arizona. And he said he'd already kind of established a relationship with one of the security guards, saying that he was a relative of somebody or something or other. And so he seemed to be fairly sure that he would be able to get in okay. And he snuck into five other Super Bowls before that. But anyway, he's promised to call within the next week and we'll get details on it at that time. Do you ever sneak into anything?
Pardon?
Have you ever sneaked into anything?
Probably have, but it's been so long ago that I've forgotten. I'm too chicken to try it now. I try to stick with the law pretty much.
It's kind of funny because Scott's theory is that when you sneak into something, you remember the sneaking in more than you remember the event.
Right.
And a lot of people call to say, I remember sneaking into this or sneaking into that and all that kind of
you
stuff.
You know, I never had that much chutzpah. You know, I was always a little, I wasn't good at that. They could see through my act, you know, and I didn't try to do that too much because, like I said, I never was successful at it. So, and I never was willing to go to jail. You know, that was always in the balance there. If you didn't win and you lost, a lot of times it'd be jail, and I wasn't willing to sneak into a movie to save a couple of bucks and end up going to jail. So,
no, I was never good at that either, and I like you, I was chicken. I was a coward.
That's
I just
me.
Yeah, that's me too, and I never dared do that. But this guy Scott has, it says he's been into five. Now six Super Bowls. I assume he was successful on this one. And it's also been the World Series that have been all sold out and all kinds of contests and all that. He says the main thing is to look like you belong. And I think that's true. You know,
Yeah. You
just walk in there with bravado.
Yeah, you got to be an outrageous dude to start with.
Yeah, you just walk in like you belong.
Yeah.
And people say, boy.
And just take over.
Yeah, you don't just kind of sneak in and glance around.
Well, I'm just interested if he was successful or not because I called down there and alerted security and say, be on the lookout for a guy with a week's growth of beard and a baseball hat calling himself Justin, claiming to be best friends of the head of security. So,
no, that's right. You got it exactly right. I forget.
He probably had that baseball hat on sideways, by the way.
Oh, yeah, everybody wears it that way now,
yeah.
Either sideways or backwards.
Yeah.
Because he was in the USA Today had a story on him on the 26th. What day would that have been, Friday or something like that, 27, 8, 9, yeah, would have been Friday. And so as a result of being in the, you know, big story on him with his picture in the story as well, and so security was alerted to him, and he claimed even federal people were there or something, and they had his picture posted, and so they were looking for him. But apparently he did grow that beard.
Yeah.
As a result, maybe look different.
He wanted to go incognito.
Incognito is exactly right, Billy Clyde.
Indeed. Well, I read a downbeat today, and it had all the hot spots for jazz in Boston, and none of which you've ever mentioned. So I'm questioning now at age 70 just how much you really get around the town.
Not too much lately.
I figured as much.
It was one of the writers of the show, Francis Essex, who spent a couple of years, as I understand, researching and writing the play, which tells the story of a man who billed himself as the greatest entertainer in the entire universe, I guess, since the beginning of time. Al Jolson is the man who the story is written about. I'm kind of rambling on in a stupid way. Now, why else would they call it Jolson if it weren't about Al Jolson? Anyway, it's playing to rave reviews at the Victoria Palace in London, England. And the writer we're talking with now is Francis Essex. And it's a delight to talk with you, Francis Essex. I gave you probably the world's worst introduction ever. But I just kind of lost myself there. Are you in Spain right now?
Yeah, I'm in Spain right at this moment, sitting in my salon on a lovely sunny morning. It's just after 9 o'clock here, and it's a gorgeous day. How are you?
I'm just fine. Now, what are you doing in Spain?
We live here.
Oh, that would account for that then. I see. Where in Spain are you?
Well, it's on the south coast. It's an area called the Costa Blanca. And it's in between two cities, a very pretty city called Valencia and a not-so-pretty city called Alicante. And we're right between those, behind a little fishing village, living up in the mountain among orange groves and citrus groves. It's a lovely spot of the world.
And you have written a whole lot of things, and the current show, which is playing in London, is on Jolson. And what decided you about Al Jolson?
Well, it's not so much what decided me about Al Jolson, it's who decided me about Al Jolson, because there's three guys in London who are leading theatre impresarios. One of them is Paul Elliott, another is Laurie Mansfield, and with them is a very well-known film producer over here called Greg Smith. And they called me. And these are the guys, I might say, who actually put on Buddy, which was a musical about Buddy Holly.
And that ran forever.
It's still running. It's in its seventh year here in London. It didn't do so good on Broadway. I think it was about 3 months. But that was around Gulf War time, so we all blame that. But anyway, they called me, and they said, would I like to write a piece about how I would put the story of Al Jolson within the context of a stage musical? With people like that, you say yes. And it was a simple question, but the actual answer to that question took initially 7 months of very hard research indeed. And thanks to a lot of superb American organizations and American individuals, 7 months later, I knew as much about Al Jolson as anybody in the world. What I didn't know was how the devil I was going to put it on stage within the context of a stage musical.
Then, did you listen to him? Had you been that familiar with Al Jolson? I mean, not as familiar, obviously, as you got to be later on. But were you a fan of his? Had you heard a lot of his things before
then? Oh, yeah. And being a fan and sort of fairly ignorant of the man caused some difficulties. Because, you know, really, all I actually knew about him I got from the Columbia picture, The Jolson Story.
Mm.
And I'll sort of talk more about that later, if I may. But, you know, that pictured him as a lovely guy wanting to impress his mother and so on. But with the research, it turns out that he had this incredible charisma on stage, absolutely unmatched anywhere else at that time. Off stage, it was a different matter. And
off stage, he was an obnoxious human being with an ego the size of the world. Would you sum it up that way, do you think, or am I overdoing that?
No, I think you've probably got it about right, Norm. Mm. He, obnoxious is maybe a bit strong. He was totally single-minded towards his own stardom. And he didn't like anything which was going to interfere with that. If, for example, there was anybody else in the same show who got a big, big round of applause, that person's job was in danger.
Mm.
He was totally single-minded. Now, what I had to do was, first of all, decide that you can't do a musical about an obnoxious man, because who wants to see that? At the same time, you can't irresponsibly ignore it. And so I had to find a reason for it. And it, that was a long, long time coming. Do you want to hear the reason now?
I'd love to hear the reason. Please tell us.
Well, it came out of this movie, The Jolson Story. Now, I don't know how many of your listeners recall this movie, but...
I think there were two. There were two, wasn't there? There were two Jolson stories.
Yes. The second one was Jolson Sings Again.
So, that's right, with Larry Parks playing, or at least mouthing the Jolson songs, with Jolson himself actually on the soundtrack.
Absolutely right.
Hmm.
Well, in that first movie was his mother. His mother was one of the characters in that story. But in real life, Jolson's mother died when he was 8 years old.
Oh, my. I didn't realize that.
And, moreover, she died in childbirth, and he watched her die. Now, if you can think of any greater shock for a kid than that, and that gave me the key to my story, his mother had bought him from Lithuania along with his brothers and sister. His father had gone on before him, that was the cantor, and he'd got himself a job in New York, and the family followed on. And that was one horrendous journey for them. And he was really so close to his mother. And he promised his mother that he was going to make it. And that is what my story is about. It gives him a reason, and the audience understand why he's doing these things. I let it out little by little, you know, as the play develops. But it's perfectly clear at the end.
What I find intriguing is the fact that you're doing so well in London, and I've got a whole bunch of reviews here, and everybody thinks absolutely superb, and they compare it with the movie, saying, you know, yours is real and the movie was not. I wondered about an English audience being that enthusiastic about a show about an American performer. Obviously, the fact that he's an American performer is no hindrance at all. People seem to love the show anyway.
No, there is an interest. Sorry. There is an interest in Al Jolson. He has a huge fan club over in the UK still. And anybody of over the age of 50 remembers him. I mean, right here in Spain, there's a few English people. They have all heard of Al Jolson. And in fact, 54 of us sort of went across specially just to see the show, which was nice neighbors and so on. People do know Al Jolson. And they also know him, and this was another problem I had to get over, as the entertainer who blacked up.
Yes, for the minstrel shows, yeah.
Yeah, that's right.
And not only minstrel shows, but actually put on blackface just to sing some of his songs, even outside of the minstrel show era.
That's right. It became his trademark.
Yes.
Now, in those days, blacking up was a genuine sign of affection for black people. And indeed, Al Jolson belonged to several black clubs and so on, and he there was a great mutual liking. But that was in the 1920s. And now in the 1990s, black people, quite rightly, and you know, and I really totally understand this, they resent it. They really do resent it. But then how do you do a musical about a man who blacked up and not have him black up?
No, that's right. That's right.
And so I won't tell you how I solved that one, but I can say that I promised. There was a lot of interest before the show went on, and a lot of newspapers wanted to comment on this. I think maybe with an idea possibly of stirring it up. But I was able to say before the show, and it's been proved subsequently, nobody but nobody is going to be offended.
Did this show open on Broadway? I should know that, and I don't. Did it open directly in London?
Opened directly in London, yes.
Okay, so it hasn't played the United States yet?
No. Nope. I think things are in motion. In fact, I believe the weekend that's just finished, Paul Elliott and Laurie Mansfield have been over in America with interested. There's a lot of interest in Broadway, maybe 97 or something like that.
Okay, now, how did you decide on the leading person, who's Brian Connolly, as I understand, plays the part of Jolson? That must have been kind of tough, getting somebody who could do Jolson and yet, you know, do an imitation of Jolson. I don't know. I mean, how does he do that?
Well, that was like winning a lottery, that was, getting Brian Connolly. It's a play with music. So we were basically looking for someone who could act. The fellow has to be able to act because there's a lot of very, very big and tough scenes. What we didn't want was a Jolson impersonator. We wanted someone who would have a great, great charisma on stage.
Mm.
Well, that meant we needed... hang on one second.
Yes.
Sorry, it's the early morning frog in the throat.
Okay.
We needed a man who was used to holding the stage by himself, a variety man, in other words, who could have a rapport with the audience. And so we were looking for something, as you say, that was quite difficult. Personally, I didn't mind if he didn't sound like Jolson, because at the end of it all, it was going to be the charisma of our performer that was going to make or break our evening, rather than someone trying to impersonate Al Jolson. Well, along came Brian Connolly, who is a variety man. He started life as a comic. He sounds, when he sings, like Al Jolson. And he's a great actor. And so it absolutely fell... No, that's wrong. It didn't fall into our laps. So a lot of work went on by Paul Elliott and Laurie Mansfield finding this guy. And indeed, he was so busy over here, we had to wait a year before he was available. He is incredible, as those notices you've got say. He's marvelous. Yeah. A hell of a nice guy.
Everybody says that. Yeah, I've got probably about a half dozen reviews here, all just praising him. Now, is he English?
Yes, he's comes from the East End of London.
So no, he has to lose his British accent or gain an American accent while he's performing?
You know, people can't believe it. You know, he on stage, he is... to English ears, I have to say this, to English ears, he is American. And so is the entire cast. Sometimes when Americans hear English American, they raise a quizzical eyebrow, let's put it that way. But he sounds American to British ears. And to my ears, because I've spent an entire career working with Americans. I'm an America-ophile, if there's such a word.
Okay.
And, no, he's very good. Then the moment he comes off stage, it's the full East End bit. Hello, darling.
It's kind of funny because back I remember back in the, maybe in the early 50s or 40s, there were a lot of English vocalists who sang with an American accent.
Yeah.
Or Americans would say they sang without a British accent. I mean, we look at it backwards maybe that way. But as soon as they got off stage, they talked British. You know, they talked with a very strong English accent.
Yes.
I've often wondered that. I asked a few of them. I'm trying to think of who they were. There was one who was billed as the British Frank Sinatra. And I can't think of what his name was. But he had no accent, no British accent at all. He sounded American until he started to talk beyond that. And I remember asking him, you know, why do you do it? Why don't you sing it in your own way? And he said it was kind of hip to sound American. Obviously, that's not quite the case in with the Jolson show that you got going. Since Jolson was an American, it would be kind of funny if he sang British. Now, does he talk with an American accent also? He must.
Yes, he does. Yes, he does. And there are two principal characters, Al Jolson, and then I've wrapped all Al Jolson's agents over his career into one person. Louis Epstein is the character who was originally one of his agents and shaped his career quite considerably. And that is played by a man called John Bennett. And they both have perfect American accents. Ruby Keeler is played by a girl called Sally Ann Triplett, and she is beautifully English off stage, but great American. I hesitate about all this. There are some actors to whom they are to the American language what Dick Van Dyke was to Cockney.
Oh, yes.
And we know this. But I think you'll be impressed with this cast when you come over and see it. You are coming over to see it, of course, aren't you?
I would love to see the show. I don't know if I can get over to England to see it. Maybe I will. It's a good excuse for going to England, to London, especially a city that I love a lot.
Come on, Norm, don't hang about. Get on a plane.
Okay, Francis. Okay,
you don't work during the days, do you?
No, well, we can hop out there for a couple of days, I suppose. I'm the more I read about this, the more I talk to you about it, the more I really do want to see it. Is the theater's playing, who's that, the Victoria?
Victoria Palace.
Is that a big theater?
It holds about 1,500, I guess.
Really?
And my wife and I had been on a Christmas vacation in the Far East, and we got back about 5:30 in the morning one Wednesday, and I went into the matinee just to sort of have a look to see how it was all going on, and I couldn't find a seat to sit in.
Mm.
There was not a single seat.
It
was absolutely packed on the Wednesday matinee.
Oh, isn't that lovely? And the British theater, the whole scene, I guess is still pretty much alive. It's sort of fizzled out in New York and in Boston, where we used to be a big tryout city. It hasn't, you know, fizzled totally, but it's not the theater scene that used to be. Is it still pretty exciting in England?
Yes. What you always find is that if there is a recession, the top shows, there's usually four or five shows, and they're mostly done by Andrew Lloyd Webber, the top shows aren't affected in that they simply turn away less people than they turn away when times are good. It is the theatres which are struggling a little bit. Those are the ones that usually sort of go down and shows come off. But the big shows very seldom come off as a result of recession. I'm surprised to hear you say that about Broadway. Broadway is the center of show business in my world.
I don't know. I know that when I was in London, and this is a few years back, I thought the theater scene in London was marvelous. You could, and the prices at that time were reasonable. You could see a show in the afternoon and if you wanted to see another show at night, and just about everything was playing there in the West End. I thought it was a lovely place. Plus, I thought the theaters were terribly civilized because they used to serve alcoholic beverages. I think they may sort of do that here now to some point, but not really quite as much as England sort of started that. I thought, what a civilized society this is.
Oh, yeah, and it's very English, this. You go into the bar before the show starts, and you order your interval drink. And then when you come out, you know, the barman tells you where the drink will be. It'll be third from the right on the top shelf, he says, or it'll be on that table over there in the corner. And you come out and the whole bar is full and nobody ever touches anybody else's drink.
I think that's something. Would you mind answering some questions from people who would like to call in and talk with you? Is that okay with you, Francis Essex?
Sure.
Okay. Our number is 254-1030. Our area code to Boston is 617. Here's Ann, who's in the town and just outside of Boston, of Lexington. You're on the air with the Francis Essex, Ann.
Hi, how are you? Hi, Mr. Essex, how are you?
Hello, Ann. Nice to talk to you.
Nice to talk to you. I missed what you were saying about Ruby Keeler because I was just getting up to turn off the radio at that point and couldn't hear you over the phone. And I wanted to call to make a contribution of some theater gossip. My aunt was in the Ziegfeld Follies, probably about 1927, and I remember my grandmother telling me that Al Jolson had literally bought Ruby Keeler from a gangster. Did you hear that story?
Yeah, you're absolutely right, and it figures in my play.
Oh, okay, great. Great, very good. Well, I missed
he bought it. Buying her is a little bit strong, Anne. He soothed Johnny Costello. Johnny Irish. He was known as Johnny Costello. He smoothed his ruffled feathers when he took his girlfriend away with $1 million.
Right. Well, very good. It sounds like a wonderful play. I hope it does get to the States.
Well, so do I.
or that I can find an excuse to go to England.
Maybe you and I will go together, Ann.
Wouldn't that be lovely?
We'll sit side by side on a comfortable plane and take the heck with it. Are you married?
Well, sort of, but...
Well, sort of, I see, okay.
Hey, you two, do you want me to hang up?
No.
You'll be a witness to all of this kind of stuff, Francis. Hey, thanks for calling in.
Thank you. Nice talking to you, Jessica.
Bye-bye.
Now, you mentioned Ruby Keeler because I remember she made sort of a slight comeback a few years ago, and I don't remember whether it's 42nd Street, a show that she was in originally way back in the 20s or the 30s. And I remember then in some of the movies she made, I thought she was absolutely the clumsiest dancer I'd ever seen. I never understood why she had the degree of success that she had. She danced and sort of clotted along. The woman who plays her, you said Sally Ann Triplett.
Mm-hmm.
Is she a clumsy lady too? Are you aware of that, or you don't point that up in the play?
Well, this is a very interesting and a very, very deep point. Now, let me do it as quickly as I can. Al Jolson made a new sound in those days. The orchestrations that he had in those days was new. And the same thing applies in its own way to most of the performers of that era. You know, tap dancing was coming in. And the theater scenery had reached a certain stage and so on and so on. Now, and gramophone records, the art of recording had reached a certain stage. Now, if you were to be absolutely faithful to Al Jolson and reproduce the sound and reproduce the standard of dancing and reproduce the recording techniques that he worked with, you would be doing this guy a great disservice, because it would simply sound, to our 1996 audience, it would sound old-fashioned. And so you have the very difficult task of making it sound authentic and yet giving it this extra 1996 feel. This is particularly true of the orchestrations. You can't just have that plinky-plonk stuff that they used to do.
That's right.
You've got to add something to it, but you've got to do it in a way that the audience isn't going to notice. So that it enhances the songs rather than historically being accurate. And this applies all the way through to the scenery and to the sound amplification. They all wear radio mics nowadays because, there weren't any microphones in the 1920s. Mm. And so, therefore, I can't have any microphones on the stage because that would be ridiculous. So we use radio mics. I mean, we use little devices, don't we, to make it sound 1996 while still appearing to be authentic. And that applies to Ruby Keeler. Sally Ann Triplett is a great dancer and a great singer and a superb actress.
Okay, that certainly answers that question, because I remember, again, I won't belabor this, but I remember seeing Ruby Keeler dance, and I thought some second-year student at some dance school, well, you could do better than that. You just whet my appetite to see the show. I just would love to. And you use 30 from one of the reviews I'm looking at, says Brian Conley, of course, who plays Jolson, does 19 of the 32 songs. So there's no shortage of Jolson songs in the show.
Oh no, it's fat on songs, we've chosen the best. I mean, we've chosen all the top ones, and also they help carry the story along.
You just mentioned Andrew Lloyd Webber. I find a lot of his stuff awfully ponderous, and you've got a kind of a show that I would think must be so refreshing to so many people who just want to have a fun time and listen to those familiar songs, and all that kind of stuff. I don't know what it is I'm leading up to exactly, but as you think of Andrew Lloyd Webber, are you a fan of his or not? I hate to say that I'm not, because most people seem to be.
I'm a huge admirer, an enormous admirer. I do tend to agree with you. Some of his music is a little bit labored, but on the other hand, every show he comes up with an absolute scorching winner, which you find yourself singing as you're driving the car. How can you argue with his income?
No, I guess you can't, but I don't have fun seeing his shows. I see them very often because I kind of feel like I should, but I don't go out of the theater, whistling or humming or feeling really good about it.
Well, our show, it is refreshing. The director, Rob Bettinson, who actually co-wrote the final script with me, Rob Bettinson has brought together a huge bunch of talent, not least of all the designer. Yeah. The scenery is absolutely mind-boggling. And the finale, which I'm not going to tell you what happens, but I have not seen it on any stage at any time, not even in Vegas. It's a tremendous scenic show. I've now lost track of what I was going to say. Oh, yeah. The entire cast they bubble. And they're all sort of real people, based on real people. And at the end of the evening, there hasn't been one single performance yet where the audience aren't singing along in the final concert.
Oh, that sounds beautiful. There's a woman from Jonah, who's up in Canada, who would like to talk with you, Frances Essex, if that would be all right with you.
Yeah, isn't radio marvelous?
Hi, Joan.
Hi. This has made me feel very homesick listening to you, because I spent my youth, I'm a Londoner, and I spent my youth going to the Victoria Palace and the Palladium, when we used to be able to get into the Palladium for half a crown. And it's kind of brought back a lot of old memories listening to you about the especially about Victoria Palace.
Where in Canada are you, Joan?
I live in a place called Deep River.
Where is that?
It's about 130 miles northwest of Ottawa.
Okay, and so there's not much theater up where you are.
Oh, there's none. People say this to me sometimes. Oh, don't you, you know, what about the theater? And I said, if I never went to another theater in all my life, I've seen enough theater, you know, I've been to thousands of theaters. Because we used to go every week.
Well, I would think it's kind of...
We used to get on the bus and go to Shaftesbury Avenue, where all the theaters were, and we would walk down the street and we'd go in somewhere.
How did you end up in Deep River?
Oh, that's a long story.
I bet there's a man involved somewhere up there.
Well, yes. Originally, we came here. My husband worked, got a job here. It's a beautiful place, actually, Deep River is. Not right now because there's too much snow. But my husband passed away.
When?
All the way back in 1962. He was only 52 years old. Mm. But I've stayed
that's young.
Here.
Mm. Any, June, any hope that you could find your way back to London?
Oh, I've been back many times. The last time I was back was 1991.
Mm-hmm.
No, yes, 91, and I came back home here in 93. But I didn't go to London that year. I was staying with my brother who lived near Brighton. And actually, he was very ill, and that's why I was there.
I feel like I'm taking part in a broadcast of the BBC. I love your accents. I think they're just great.
My dad was a London bus driver for 48 years.
Really?
Yes, and he used to drive a number 38, which went down to Victoria Station, actually.
Was that a double bus?
A double-decker. Yes.
Okay. Joan, you mentioned the London Palladium. The London Palladium was one of my favorite theaters. When I was a television producer, yonks years ago, I used to produce a show called Sunday Night at the London Palladium.
Oh, yes.
And Sunday Night at the London Palladium was the leading television show of that time. And it went across to America in the sense that the American stars at their various social gatherings weren't anybody until they'd played Sunday Night at the London Palladium.
Oh, unfortunately, that interview got cut because the tape ran out. I know. But we need to be thankful for what we have.
Yay!
Next week, it's a 29-year-old dumb birthday game to tickle your eardrums. Get your tickets now because they're going fast. Not really, but it sounded cool. Closing the vault and riding the radio waves home. For Harry Carey Jr., John Ford, Bud Greenspan, Francis Essex, Al Jolson, Spain, London, England, Scott Kerman, sneaking into the Super Bowl, Barry Farber, Ruby Keeler, Movie Heroes, Victoria Palace, Bob Ames, the lovely Marilyn Gorelnick, and the man who's doing all right, but that's because he has low standards, Norm Nathan. I'm Tony Nesbitt.